You're listening to the Roundtable Podcast, episode 34. Hello, friends. I'm Dave Robison.
And I'm Ryan Stevenson, filling in for Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to the Roundtable Podcast.
Each week on the Roundtable Podcast, we bring writers in and they're on the show here to present a story idea to us and to our esteemed guest hosts.
Absolutely. And then we dig into it. We unwrap it like a cherished present at Christmas time, peeling back the layers of wrapping paper, preserving the ribbons for later use, perhaps, carefully unwrapping it so we can use it again if we want to, and ultimately evolving and rewrapping and finding some combination of goodness that will transform the raw nascent idea into literary gold.
I like the way you put it, but I'll tell you, man, I have never unwrapped a present that way in my life.
Is that not your style at Christmas time?
No, it's savage. The fact that hands are even involved is a treat for everyone else, because it's usually teeth and gnashing and spittle and pure emotion.
Wow. Oh, yeah. See, my dad has taught me how to do this, and it's there's the hand under the edge and the gentle slide to smoothly pop the tape rather than tear it from the paper. It's anal, man. It's complete OCD, and that's just how you did it. So, you know, because you want to preserve those things.
So. I guess so. Yeah.
Well, and once again, Ryan, let me express gratitude, man. It is a genuine pleasure having you as my wingman on this episode.
It's a treat for me too. I mean, Brian does a good job of keeping this, the butt creases that Brian left, they're perfect.
Yes, they're deep and wide. Oh. And he's going to kick my ass for that one.
I'm just falling into them. Yeah,
That's right. Just settle in. Don't push them out of whack. Otherwise, he'll be really grumpy when it comes back. So... But enough about Brian's wide, deep butt. Let's classy up this episode just a little bit.
See what we can do. Yeah.
And I have the perfect thing. Let's introduce our guest host, who is nothing mm-hmm. but class. You met him last week, or just a couple of days ago, rather, at the 20 Minutes With segment, author of The Knights of Breton Court, editor of both of the Dark Faith anthologies, a distinguished gentleman of faith, scholasticism, and creative mojo, and, as we learned, an exotic dancer, which, you know, carries a lot of weight in this part of the country. So please welcome back to the large chair at the round table, Mr. Maurice Broaddus. Maurice, thank you so much for coming back and helping us workshop a story, man.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Absolutely. We couldn't pass up an opportunity. So are you comfy? Is your drink full? Everything groovy on that end?
Here you go. Oh, I don't know if you can pick that up.
Sexy sounds of clinking ice in a glass. Maurice, you know, just looking at the schedule between Knights of Breton Court, between the Dark Faith projects, and the other things that you have going on, I can only assume that your schedule is an epic thing. What's coming up? What do fans and listeners need to know to watch out for from the desk of Maurice Broaddus?
Well, the things about ready to drop are like you said, the Dark Faith Invocations. That's the sequel to Dark Faith. That is up for pre-order right now, and hard copy should be arriving any day now.
Sweet.
And then the Knights of Breton Court, the Omnibus Edition, is being released here at the end of the month. So you'll be able to pick up all three books. That's Kingmaker, King's Justice, and King's War, all rolled into one. And so that'll be hitting at the end of the month. And then after that, let's see, this is my big convention month. So I was just at Worldcon, but coming up, I will be at KillerCon out in Vegas. That's hosted by Rath James White.
Oh, wow.
And then I'll be at Context over in Columbus, Ohio at the end of the month. And I'm leading a couple workshops over there. So I'm jetting around the country as much as I can these days.
You're making your face be seen. That's awesome.
Exactly.
That's awesome. Now, you're also working on some stories that step out of your native horror vibe. Is that not true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, the things that will keep me squirreled away this fall and winter. I'm doing a middle grade detective novel, and that's because I would go into schools to help kids with creative writing and encourage them to do creative writing, but they'd always ask, well, can we read your novels? And I'm like, oh, not even a little bit. And so I wanted to get something that would be a little bit more age appropriate for them. And so the idea of a middle grade detective novel, it just really appealed to me, okay. Especially since crime fiction is a big love of mine. So, you know, if I can get that down to the elementary grade level, I'm all the happier.
Sure.
And then the other project is a steampunk novel, which is I'm basically taking my short story that was published in Apex magazine called Pimp My Airship.
Okay, right.
and I'm turning that into a novel-length work. And actually, alongside that, I'm actually doing a Jamaican steampunk novel at the same time. So
Jamaican steampunk. Now, what defines Jamaican steampunk?
Oh, all right. This is more of a craft issue, but my favorite phase of writing is the world-building stage.
Okay.
And so when I sat down to write Pin My Airship, well, I built this very, very elaborate universe for the story to take place in, just to write a 5,000-word story.
It's a good question.
Right. And so in my steampunk universe, well, Jamaica was never conquered and never colonized.
Okay.
And so Jamaica, but America was. America is still a colony of Great Britain in my universe.
Ah, okay.
And so...
So Jamaican's a power.
Jamaica's a power in this world. And so I wanted to write a story that takes place, you know, strictly in Jamaica, was still firmly ensconced in the tradition of steampunk, but was reflective of more people of color, frankly, because that's something that's actually largely absent in most steampunk stuff. So I wanted to be most definitely. You can't escape people of color in my universe. And plus, you don't know this about me, but I love clothes.
Okay.
And big part of steampunk is the clothes and costuming and everything like that. And I wanted an excuse.
Oh, I see.
Thank you.
I see. Right. So you write a steampunk book so you can go and dress up at all the shows.
That's up. So if this thing gets published next year, I can guarantee you, next con season, I'm punked out.
Oh, your Facebook page is going to have a whole album just for that. Sweet.
I gotta ask. It's a requirement. The nationality that I represent is clamoring to know in your universe, where's Canada stand in all that?
You know, that's a good question.
Yeah.
So like in our universe, Canada is pretty much marginalized.
So it's the same. That's what I was just wondering. Is everyone's like, I don't know.
Lee America, basically.
Well, Maurice, we will make sure all of that awesomeness makes it into the liner notes. And if anything else occurs to you between now and when the show actually airs, let me know. We'll make sure it gets in there. I want to make sure everybody is able to access the fabulosity that is Maurice Broaddus. Mm-hmm. But for now, gentlemen, if I may, what say you? We pause for a brief promotional break while we share some airtime with a very cool ebook or another awesome podcast. And when we come back, we workshop a story. Sound good?
Right on.
I like it too. I think it's a good idea. So, folks, you guys stay put. We'll be right back.
No place like home.
He was too proud to call for you when he got sick, Ty. But I knew he wanted to see you.
Well, if it isn't the little stooge come home at last.
Don't you see it yet? Ty's got himself in a lot of trouble for coming here.
Come tomorrow, there's gonna be a lynch mob outside our door.
How long does he have?
It'll be tonight.
It's a hard thing, Ty, to come home like this.
Thank you for sending for me by.
Watch that monster, boy. He's here for our souls. But I've been ready for him. Been expecting you back.
It's a bloody shame folks gotta hold on to what scares him so tight.
Of all the times to bring one of them here. Of all the damn times.
Harlan's Wake by John Miro. Find this and other full cast stories at the Doonstief Audio Fiction Magazine. The music for this trailer is courtesy of Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com.
Well, with the appetizers out of the way, and I trust me, those are some delicious appetizers right there, man.
Thank you. Thank you. We try and set a good table here.
We got to dig into the main course here, though. That's why people come to the restaurant that is the Roundtable Podcast. The story workshop, the meat and potatoes. No meal, mental or otherwise, it's worth its weight in salt until a chef brings those ingredients to the feast. So I need to know, Dave, this week, who's our chef?
Oh, our guest chef. I love that. Our chef, Ryan, is actually a master chef with a diversity of skills beneath his chef's apron. He is a podcaster, one of the hosts of the Galley Table Podcast. He has creative works out there in the world. Battle Him is available at his website in both audio and e-text versions. Now, this is an anime homage, send up big giant robots kicking each other's butt type of thing. And that just sounds beyond awesome. And on top of that, he is an editor for the flagship at Flying Island Press. And you can find out more about those guys at flyingislandpress.com. So Ryan, our master chef, please welcome him to the Sioux station here at the round table, Mr. Zachary Ricks. Zachary, dude, I know it's never easy to offer your baby up for scrutiny, and we are so grateful that you did. Thank you, sir.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and getting to talk about it with Maurice is going to be a big thrill.
Yes, it's going to be fabulous. Yeah. But Zachary, tell me, you've got a lot of stuff going on. You've obviously got some geekage going on with the podcasting angle of things. You're obviously a writer of some skill and an editor as well. Where does all this come from? How did that happen?
Oh, gosh, I blame it all on my mother.
Really?
Just get me a couch and I'll tell you all about it.
Oh, see, no, this is not the Freudian round table. We're not going there, dude.
Yeah. Well, so I grew up in a little town in southeast Idaho, and we didn't have cable, but what we did have is books. And my mom read to me as a kid, and I learned to read really, really young. And so eventually I was, I think, about 7 or 8 years old, and I had read everything in the house that was age appropriate.
Wow.
But down in the basement, there was this one shelf of books that was way up. You had to kind of climb to get up to that had all the books with the really interesting looking covers on them.
Oh, dude, this is a Spielberg movie. Keep going. Do tell.
So I'm 8 years old. I'm climbing up. I'm looking at the covers of my mom's collection of Piers Anthony Xanth novels.
Oh, and my goodness.
Alan Dean Foster and the Flink series and John Carter of Mars.
Oh, classics.
And I fell in love. And so, you know, that just kind of went on. I'm 10 years old, and I'm carting around a copy of The Sword of Shannara. It's like a 1,000-page paperback novel tucked under my arm in fifth grade. I'm just do-do-do-do-do. And so eventually I started getting the idea that maybe I would try writing. I tried it a little bit in high school, came up with, you know, did a lot of world building. In college, I took a class or two on creative writing, and then I kind of went away from it for a long time. Until podcasting came around. And I started hearing people like Scott Sigler and J.C. Hutchins and T. Morris. And eventually I got into NaNoWriMo and I started writing. I'm 4 for 4 right now on NaNoWriMo novels.
Go, man. That's awesome. God, and you know, podcasting and NaNoWriMo are like the two primary gateway drugs for writers in the new millennia, man. I'm telling you. Everybody that comes on, it's either podcasting that kicked them over the top or NaNoWriMo that really kickstarted their engines and got them into it. That's awesome, Zach. And are you participating in NaNoWriMo this month or this year?
I'm a municipal liaison for the Austin, Texas region.
Really?
Yep.
Dude, we're going to have to talk afterwards because I am only peripherally aware of the mechanics of NaNoWriMo. I wasn't aware that there were officers involved. But let's not talk about that now. You brought a story, did you not?
Yes, I did.
Good. I actually had somebody at one point say, did I? I don't know. Scared the crap out of me. But thank you, Zach, for not pushing me over that edge. Okay, sir, we're going to give you 5 to 8 minutes. Give us the title of the story, the genre, the format. Is it a novel, a series of short stories, whatever you got going on there? Introduce us to the world, to the characters. Give us some basic signposts of the actual story itself. And we'll start workshopping it, sir. So we'll get out of your way. The mic is yours.
All right. Now, a couple of years ago, Scott Roche and I co-wrote a little story called The Battle of Wildspitz, in which we which started out as a riff that I did on Twitter about dragon riding pirates, which eventually became kind of this bizarre mashup of steampunk and fantasy set in pre-World War I England. And that is the world that this story takes place in. It's kind of called, and this is a horrible title, I will fix this later, Norris Tilney and the Western Wild. So it's a historical alternate history fantasy, and the pitch line is, you take James Bond, you put him in Harry Potter's world during the time of Downton Abbey.
That's awesome.
So the way it works is you've got a young wizard who's recruited to a secret intelligence agency of Edwardian England's government. He's sent to ensure the success of a historic accord between the British Empire, the United Indian Tribes, and the Republic of Texas, because this is a world where the American Revolution never happened. He has to stop the Bolsheviks from awakening a great dragon that is sleeping under what is now Yellowstone National Park. So that's, you know, Norris, of course, is he's a wizard. And he was recruited as a cadet into this special order of the British Ministry, a covert organization that is supposed to keep an eye on threats to the British Empire, threats to the people, and threats especially to the crown. He is steady. He is intelligent. He's determined. But he suffers because he looks like a big, blonde, stupid guy. And he has no fortune or family connections. So when he went to the academy to learn magic, some of those classes you have to be sponsored for. And so he'd never got into a lot of the more advanced stuff because he didn't have the connections, he didn't have the family, and nobody really looked at him twice. So he's had years of people treating him like a big, dumb ox and academy students looking down their noses at him. So he winds up coming out of the academy without a lot of confidence in himself, which is kind of his main weakness. He's also more than a little socially awkward. He doesn't do well around the fairer sex. So he's really looking to prove himself and prove that he really does belong in this organization of hyper-competent people. Because, you know, it's MI6. It's James Bond. These people are the very, very best at what they do. And he really doesn't understand what it is that they see in him. And he's trying to figure out, is this really the place where I belong? So he travels to America to kind of help this accord come off. And one of the people that he meets there is the main female protagonist, whose name is Phoebe Carter. She's the granddaughter of Annie Oakley and is a lot like her grandma. She trained herself to be a sharpshooter, and she's a good writer, and she's really tough, and she loves being out in the wild. And she really wants that kind of life for herself, a life that's more free than what she thinks her parents really want for her and what the guys who keep wooing her really want. They want her to be, you know, the little woman at home. And she's just not really down with that. She really likes this guy who's after her, but she doesn't want the life that he wants for her. And then you've got the bad guy, whose name is Branson in this. He is a member of the British Ministry who's been sent over as the assistant to the person who's actually going to be doing the negotiations, somebody that the Indian tribes will respect, somebody that the Republic of Texas will respect, and that's Annie Oakley herself, who was alive during this period. And so he sees, first of all, his demotion as a real insult to himself. He also believes that if trade really does open up on a big scale between the Indians and the Brits and the Texans, that the mechanization and the westernization of the Indian tribes will be a foregone conclusion, and he's really not very happy about that. He sees their culture as being more pure, as being more close to nature, and so he's trying in subtle ways to sabotage the negotiations, which eventually leads to him doing the unthinkable and trying to awaken this giant dragon that is sleeping under, Yellowstone National Park. And the fact that he is, a closet socialist doesn't really help any of this. Something else that was kind of going on at the time. As for the story, the conflict is pretty obvious. You've got a guy who's trying to prove himself in a situation that he didn't expect. You've got a woman who's trying to find a role for herself in society that doesn't fit what everybody else wants. And then you've got a guy who sees the inevitable march of history and westernization and mechanization as something that's really bad, trying desperately to preserve what he sees as a more pure culture, and they all just kind of wind up conflicting with each other in various different ways.
All right, boom. So as far as the actual events as they unfold, you've got nothing outlined or in particular, other than the broad, here are the general conflicts, they're going for the dragon, not sure how it's all going to come out.
Well, kind of, sort of. I mean, okay. The traditional kind of James Bond film done in a book form, and those have a real formula to them.
Sure.
You open up with a giant action set piece, which in this will happen in Imperial Japan. At the time, Japan and Britain had really good relations. Britain was helping to industrialize Japan. And so Norris is called in with a couple other people from the agency to help save a kidnapped royal from one of those giant Japanese pagoda palace things.
Sure.
And during the course of this, he sees how, you know, again, incredibly skilled the people that he's working with are, and he perceives himself as not being up to their snuff. He breaks his sword. A couple other things happen during that really cause him to question himself and his role.
Okay.
He goes back to the agency, and they send him across to New York City to meet Annie Oakley, deliver some papers that are, you know, kind of instructions, kind of, you know, secret documents that he doesn't really get to see. And he's supposed to bring her response back to the agency. Well, when he gets there, she gets the paper, she looks over them, and she refuses to give him her response until the deal is done. And so she basically says, you have to come with me, and I will give you my response when I give you my response. But in the meantime, you're coming along with us. You have the trek out west, which will have, you know, occasional hiccups and bad guys and stuff like that. Kind of the, you know, the smaller, I'm going to go through these guys quick kind of henchmen kinds of things happening. They get to the negotiations. Things may or may not be going along well. All this time, there's kind of a romantic triangle that's developing between Phoebe and Norris and a third party who will be part of the Texas delegation. When things start to go really well with the negotiation, that's when Branson steps in and stages a kidnapping. Gets himself kidnapped and gets Annie Oakley kidnapped and taken deeper into Indian territory. It's kind of the end of Act 2. Norris, Phoebe, and a couple other people go after them, discover that Branson has actually not been kidnapped, but he's kind of in charge of the guys, and that they're going to basically take Annie Oakley out and shoot her full of arrows in the middle of Indian country and thus destroy the possibility of a trade agreement. When they stop that, that's when Branson finally says, well, there's only one other way to do this then, and that is to, you know, set loose this thing that's powering all the geological stuff that happens at Yellowstone National Park. And so he rides off to basically unleash hell on everybody who's getting in his way, because he's just, you know, he's insulted, he's been put down upon, he's being manipulated by somebody behind the scenes that we won't really see in this book. Kind of, you know, you always have the henchman, but then back in the back, you've got that guy stroking the cat. And so guy stroking the cat is back there, but you won't necessarily see him or know that he's there unless he gets maybe a mention as Branson is, you know, choking out his last breath in the end of the book.
Okay. Let me ask you, Zach, before we get into this, what is it that you're hoping to get out of the ensuing conversation?
Well, there are a couple of things that concern me. I have not been really successful at writing something that's much longer than 50, 60,000 words. I can hit it pretty well. But something like this, I'm feeling the need for a lot more structure to it. And also something like this, I have to have a naturally developing love story happen. The action bits I can write. I know the action bits. But at the end of the day, this really is a story about the things you do for love. You know, Norris is doing things for love of his country and the love he feels for the people in this agency who've taken him in a bad spot, and this growing love he feels for Phoebe and this desperate yearning for a place for himself to call home. And Phoebe is kind of doing the same thing. And I've to be able to bring that message out. The things you do for what you, the things you do for love, the things that you do in search of a home, a place where you can be.
Okay, you hear that, Mr. Style? You hear that, Marquise? We're going to be able to get that romance thing working at some point during this conversation. That's awesome. All right, very cool. Zach, we can help. I think we can help. I think you've got a collection of individuals here that can definitely give you some direction along those lines. Ryan, are you familiar with our disclaimer?
Yes, I am familiar with.
Would you be so kind as to share that with the rest of these gentlemen so we're all on the up and up here?
You got it. Okay, guys, over the course of this discussion, there's going to be lots of things that are thrown around by myself, by Dave, by Maurice. Zach, I want to remind you at this point that anything we all say could be total poop. All right, this is your story and yours to shape. We're bringing what we believe are the best sensibilities to this story, but at the end of the day, this is 100% yours. Do you understand that?
I understand, and I'm ready to go.
Awesome. Well done. Well done, Ryan. That was masterfully executed. All right. Let's get this ball on the road here. Ball on the road. No, I don't think that's the metaphor I was looking for.
Hey, that works for me. Canadian.
You okay with that?
Road hockey, dude.
Sweet.
Come on,
awesome.
Now. Yep, we're good.
Okay. We generally go around the table one time and get initial impressions, and we always defer to our guest host. So, Maurice, first impressions of Zach's story idea. What are your thoughts? Any questions of clarification you might have? Go ahead and kick us off with this discussion.
Well, my first thought, actually, I had a concern immediately when he said that he hadn't written anything basically over 50,000 words. Because this story, I mean, as I'm kind of like laying it out in my head, I'm like, ooh, I'm looking at what 180,000 words possibly for this thing. Because the story sounds fairly epic. I mean, you're talking about jumping from Japan, you know, to England, to America, traveling across country. That's a lot of ground to cover. So that was like the first thing that hit me. It's like, ooh, this could potentially spiral out of control.
You may want to expand your word count goal.
Right. My second concern was just with the how much world building has gone into this. Because like I said, world building is one of my big things, and especially in things like steampunk and alt history type things. So you have all these rival empires. You have you said that the Texan delegation, is that like... Is that just part of the U.S. or has Texas seceded from the rest of the U.S.?
At this point, is no U.S.
There is no U.S. Okay.
The revolution never happened.
Right.
And that whole thing was kind of resolved peacefully, and the Americans never really penetrate past the borders of the Republic of Texas, which mm-hmm. was a separate country.
Okay, so Texas is a separate country.
Yeah.
Okay. So I mean, there's just I like the idea. There's so much I like about this, and this is don't get me wrong. This is part of my own love for steampunk and everything. And so there's a whole lot that's potentially really good in this. I will say my other concern was with this Indian delegation. How are there Indian characters that play a significant role in the story, and how comfortable are you writing Indian characters, for example?
I feel like I'm going to have to do a lot more research, but I grew mm-hmm. up in the Mountain West around, there were a lot of Indians kind of around up there,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of different cultures, even though where I was living was pretty much white bread central. So
okay.
I think at the end of the day, Well, I realize I'm going to have to do a lot of research on culture, people are people.
Right.
And I think that if I can understand the motivations of the people who are involved and what they think is at play, then I think that I can comfortably write something that will look close enough. Was it David Mamet? David Mamet said he never really worried about how cowboys wrote, because if he wrote well enough, then forever after, cowboys would talk like he made them talk. It doesn't have to sound right. It has to sound authentic, and it has mm-hmm. to sound authentic enough. Because the other thing that we're talking about here is this is a completely separate world. I mean, this is a world where the Indians united and were not conquered by the Americans, were able to fight mm-hmm. back effectively. And so, things like the Battle of Little Bighorn happened, but a whole lot of other stuff happened on the Indian side where they basically just said, yeah, you see this river here? Fine, you keep what you've got over there. You cross this river, you're going to have trouble.
Okay. But the point still stands that when you say, what are they called, the United Indian States?
United Indian Nations.
The United Indian Nations. In the reader's mind, there's going to be a speculation as to what that is. And I think, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, Maurice, but being aware of that expectation on the reader's part. And then, as you say, Zach, doing that research and extrapolating out from that so that you not only meet, but obviously exceed and go beyond those expectations in your own creative, masterful way.
Mm.
So What else you got, Maurice? What other thoughts are you thinking?
What's the tone of the novel? Because one of the things that hit me was whether or not you were going to play it. Because it almost sounded like he wasn't quite a James Bond character, but he would almost be like the James Bond wannabe. He kind of flunked out of James Bond school kind of thing. Is this a lighthearted kind of tone? Are you going to concentrate mostly on the action-adventure side of things, and we're just along for the ride? I was just trying to get a feel for what the actual tone of this project's going to be.
Yeah, this is going to tend heavily towards the swashbuckling adventure.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of pausing for the deep-seated philosophical ramifications of everything that's happening. Norris himself is struggling with self-doubt, but he is a competent person, and it's the discovery of that competence within himself that's going to be, I think, one of the major themes, one of the major things that I want people to get from this. You don't know your own strength.
Okay. Does that help, Maurice?
Yeah. I'm just kind of curious about what kind of tone he was striving for during the course of the novel. So, okay.
Sure.
So I now have that firmly in place.
Okay, good.
This back to a history question. If the Revolutionary War never happened, what would be the role of like slavery and then the Civil War? Because that was something I struggled with in some of my steampunk universe stuff too. Something I had to really just think through as far as that went.
Well, we remember that slavery ended in Great Britain without the need for a big civil war.
Okay.
The one thing that I've been thinking about over the last couple of days that I haven't quite decided on yet is when did it end in Texas? It has mm-hmm. to have ended by this point. But I'm not exactly sure when it ended in Texas or if it was a part of Texas to begin with.
Has it ended in Texas?
Yes.
Okay, so that you're resolved on.
But not exactly sure how and when that happened.
Okay. Well, and that's one of the things, Maurice, that we can do in this is postulate how that happened and mm-hmm. what impact that would have on not only the Republic of Texas, but the larger world in general.
Right, right. So,
because that's the beauty of the roundtable. We can speculate. Cool. Excellent. Maurice, I'm going to have you hold on to your thoughts for just a second and move on to Ryan. Ryan, what are your first impressions, thoughts, and questions for Zach's story?
Yeah, lots of them, actually. And I want to start out by saying I just love the concept. I really do.
Yeah.
I like it when you take something that can be boiled down into a sentence or into a rudimentary sense of a set of statements, and it just feels right. And one of the first things I thought of was when you said the title, and you said you didn't really like the title. And meanwhile, I found myself thinking, you know what, I kind of do. Because it gives me an expectation of what I'm looking at. And I think it will immediately, even in its title, answer some of those questions that Maurice was asking about tone. I have a better understanding of tone based on that title.
With that daguerreotype face and the sepia tone and the whole scroll work so indicative of that era. Yeah, I can totally see that.
Yeah, and I feel too that when you take something, I don't want to dwell too much on the title because I think it's such a small piece of it is such a small piece of the greater picture we're talking about here. But when you've got a title like that that's even phrased in that that metronome that you've got it set to, it speaks to the fact that I'm looking at something that's going to play out like a book of a similar title. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but I think the point I'm trying to make is that I hear that title and I think to myself, this is an adventure. This is going to be fun. This is going to be light. I probably mm-hmm. won't go away from this with a lot of deep-seated psychological questions answered.
And very definitely a period adventure as well.
Yeah.
It has that tone infused in there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm trying to suggest here is I wouldn't look down on that title just yet. I mean, if you're not settled on it, that's fair, but I kind of like that. I want to dwell a little bit on the characters. I'm a character guy. That's my thing. World building is not my strength, but the motivations of character, that's where I really hang my hat. And there's a couple things you said that I liked. I really like the idea of Phoebe being related to a character in real history.
Yeah.
Because it grounds this, it gives me a sense of reference now, even though I don't know much about Annie Oakley, admittedly, it does give me that pin, that linchpin saying, okay, this is, even though this is a fantastic world where many things are different or played out differently, here's a common thread that you can kind of remember. And I think that a lot of stories need to have that component, the component that says, even though this is whatever, this is Star Wars and this is lightsabers and spaceships, there's a piece here that you as a reader can relate to. And I think her relation to Annie Oakley is a good linchpin for that. I think one of the catches is, though, I immediately found myself thinking she sounds exactly like Annie Oakley, to the point where you could have said it was Annie Oakley, and I would have been okay with that, too.
That's a good point.
So, yeah, and that's something I would like to come back to as we get into conversation about this.
Well, part of what's going on there is that Phoebe has a real hero worship thing going on with her grandma. Mm-hmm. And so from a very young age said, grandma's who I want to be like. Grandma's got this awesome life. She's going around on these Wild West tours and doing all of these fantastic things. And so at one point in her, you know, which may or may not come out during the actual telling of the book, at one point in her development, she actually runs away from home and heads out west and winds up, instead of having these awesome adventures, she winds up dancing in a saloon hall. And grandma's the one who walks in and finds her. And just devastating what happens at that point. So,
okay.
Okay. So that leads to, I know that we're just kind of giving initial thoughts here, so I don't want to get into this, but I would like to eventually come back to a conversation about a couple of the pieces of Phoebe that I don't see. I think once we talk about it a bit, we'll get there. Specifically, I'm going to eventually, not right now, but eventually ask you to tell me about her parents, because I'd like to know about that. I think that the relationship between Annie, her parents, or sorry, her kids, and Phoebe's parents being Annie's kids, or parent being Annie's kids, you get the idea what I'm going for here.
Sure.
The other thought I had as far as characterization goes, I love the fact that you've constantly made that reference to this being kind of James Bond and Harry Potter's world. It's going to play like a James Bond story. We're going to have that action adventure like James Bond. That's cool. Keeping in mind that the reader will never see the words James Bond paired together in this right. book, that means that I can now make assumptions about how you want this to play out, which starts to, when you started to talk about how the art, the romance felt, you know, it needed something, it needed that impetus to kind of inspire it. It's funny because with a very few exceptions, romance and James Bond in my mind have never gone together at all. So I found myself saying there is a cop-out you could take here, and obviously I'm going to suggest you don't, which is the James Bond style of romance. And that would suck. I would be heartbroken if you did that, because I don't think that's the right way to go. So I think when we get to the part where we start talking about that issue you're having, we're all going to have to take a breath and say, okay, all that James Bond talk, that needs to stop for about 5 minutes.
Yeah,
and then we can move on. Yeah. Last thing I want to say, Branson, fantastic job giving him a motivation that isn't paper thin. I think I was, when you started to talk about him, I saw mustache twirling villainy, because that's what you're going to see when you see Westerns, and I've written one, so I'd know. But the idea that he is trying to protect this culture, I think that is a great, great idea. And I think that if we build on that, you're going to have a very believable, you know, air quote here, you can't see it, villain.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very cool. Good. Good first observations. For myself, Zach, I will echo what both Maurice and Ryan have said. This world is rich, and there's much to play with. I too have some questions. First of all, this alliance between the British and the United Indian Nations and the Republic of Texas, who brokered this deal? Who wants it?
All three parties want it, but it's something that's actually being requested by the Indian Nations.
Really? Why?
Because they want to become more of an economic power.
Okay, so they don't want to be natural.
Not really.
Okay.
The thing of it is that they want to be able to determine the pace and the direction of their own mechanization and industrialization, rather than having that imposed by outside forces. They say, you know, it's inevitable this is going to happen. We're seeing a lot of our kids kind of move in these areas and wondering why we can't have things like insert modern convenience in the 1910s here.
Right, right.
Okay. When, you know, is there a way that we can do this without destroying who we are as a people? And if we can determine that for ourselves, then it behooves us to take advantage of it.
Okay. All right. That clarifies things and does some interesting things to Branson's motivations. We'll talk about that in a second. Other question is, Phoebe Carter, why is she on this expedition other than the fact that she's Annie Oakley's granddaughter?
Well, that's mostly what it is. She is Annie Oakley's granddaughter, and when they meet up in New York, she's there, and there's an assassination attempt on Annie Oakley's life.
Okay.
Which is prevented by Norris and the Texas guy, and Phoebe's there, and she shoots the guy who tried to kill her grandma. And at that point, she's like, I've got to keep an eye on what's going on because something bad is going on. And so she insists and just forces her way into it.
Okay. Okay, good. Then that's what I need to know. So she's basically royalty being brought along as a trophy and a part of the jewel of Annie Oakley, who is the real head of all of this.
Heaven help anybody who tells her she can't come.
Well, and that too, yes. I get the sense that she's a bit headstrong. Gotcha.
At the end of the day, she will follow them from a distance if she has to.
Okay. The other question I have is if Norris believes himself to be such an incompetent boob, why is he going along on such an important mission?
Yep.
He doesn't know it's an important, he doesn't realize everything he's going to get into. As far as he's concerned, he's just there to drop off these papers, get the response, and come back. And he thinks, this is pretty much my speed. I can do this.
Okay, why doesn't he then, when it becomes more than that, when he becomes an escort to the most important person in this whole delegation that Britain wants so badly, why is he not pulled off immediately and replaced by a cadre of highly skilled elite Delta Ops wizards?
Well, don't think that there won't be other guards going.
Okay.
Annie's the one who insists on him coming.
Why?
That is an excellent question.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We'll put that out there on the table. Put a pin in that bad boy as well. Excellent. Okay, I've got other ideas and story notions. One thing I'm going to put out before I pass the mic back to Maurice is Ryan's observation. I see where you're coming from, Zach, and it's our job at the round table to throw out alternatives. And Ryan's observation that having Phoebe be a mirror image of Annie Oakley, I think, might bear a little more consideration because the name Annie Oakley is going to evoke all of the qualities that we've spoken about. The firebrand, the wearing trousers and shooting wings off a gnat at 300 paces and yada yada. And I'm a big fan of subverting expectation. I think it's a strong, strong writing tool on the part in a writer's toolkit. And I can see Phoebe Carter growing up with people saying, oh my God, you're Annie Oakley's granddaughter? Shoot something. I want to see. And really resenting the fact that her whole worth and value is being gauged by her grandmother and not by herself. And by wanting to stand alone and separate, I think that might make her a stronger character. And have her being, as a part of the delegation, be as one of the government delegates who's handling the very important details of this, because Annie Oakley is basically a figurehead, having her be a much more important member of the cabinet gives her a stronger motivation for being there. She can still be badass, but not, she doesn't have to be that stereotypical cardboard cutout of Annie Oakley. And that also then might give her and Norris a little more of a common ground where the roots of romance can grow. I put that out there as a consideration. So back to you, Maurice. What can we do to, what do you think about what's been said so far? And what can we do to tighten up what we've got?
Well, I'm curious. So Norris is a part of this organization. I'm a little unclear about what exactly is the nature of this organization he's a part of. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, there's actually kind of a lot of word building that went into this. The organization grew out of a need for the British Crown to address magical threats, which they did not have prior to, whenever. And the organization actually started out as a group of pirates. I'm hijacking the idea from that fantastic novel, Captain Blood. And so the organization is actually called the Croix du Sang, which I think is French for Cross of Blood. And so it starts from this guy who was a magician who was wrongfully accused of treating somebody at the Battle of Sedgemoor, I think it was, gets sold to slavery in Bermuda, gets free, becomes a pirate. It's basically the Peter Blood story, but with magic kind of thrown into it. And when he agrees to come back to the throne, he starts this organization because part of the thing that happens with him is these magical threats. And so from that point forward, it's an association that views itself with a very liberal amount of power. They're not necessarily officially a part of the ministry. They're looked down upon by other elements of the ministry. The people who run it are iconoclasts, but they're fantastically powerful and competent iconoclasts, so that when people do kind of try to mess with them, as happens occasionally in all kinds of territorial and political fights, they always seem to come out on top.
Quick question, Zach. Quick question. Is Britain the only one that has an agency like this, or are there other people practicing magic in the world?
Other people are definitely practicing magic in the world.
Cool.
And that's one
it.
Of the things cool. that Norris likes about this whole thing, because he wants to be able to go out and see the different magic that's performed by other people. It's mentioned in the first story that we did that he wanted to go specifically to America and see the Indian shamans perform their magic, because their magic was so different from the magic that's performed in Europe.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and that was getting to where my next question was, is why does Norris want to be a part of this group? You know, does is this a legacy thing where his father was a member of this? Is this does he have some sort of, I don't know, something in his past that said, hey, I need to be a part of this group? Was he recruited because he had so much potential? I mean, how did he get here?
Well, that's the first story that Scott and I wrote is that story.
Okay.
He finds himself...
In two sentences or less.
Okay, two sentences. He is on an airship that is attacked by dragon-riding pirates. On that airship is the wife of the head of this order, and she sees Norris's potential, and during the course of that story, basically recruits him.
So he has potential that other people see, but what's drawing him to the organization? And
yeah,
to
really,
the cause?
Right now he has no agency. He's following what everybody else is doing,
which is a problem.
Okay.
For the first two things that I did with him.
Okay. Maurice, what can we do to give him a little more agency?
Hey, look, I'm good at coming up with a problem, you know, solution.
Yeah. Oh, no, you can't throw out a problem without throwing out a solution. Sorry, house rules.
All right.
Oh. As let me jump in here and see if this fixes it, because okay. One of the things that happened to Norris is that because of what happened in that first story, his post was destroyed. You know, the dragon-riding pirates basically blew up the airship from under his feet. He escaped, and the wife escaped. Everyone else died, and Norris was made the scapegoat. The head of the agency steps in the course of his court-martial, mm-hmm. and basically says, you know, give me your wand. You're going to do this one thing for me, and then we're going to go back to the court-martial, and everything's going to be fine. So he gives him his wand. He goes and does the one thing. They come back, and he's totally court-martialed. He's thrown under the bus. They're going to break his wand, and when they find out that Lucius has it, everybody all of a sudden just kind of goes, well, crap, fine. Norris has to do something. He's been dishonored at this point. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks that he is a coward and a deserter, because that's the story they tell everybody when they court-martial him, is that he ran away from his post and he was never on the airship in the first place. It's the only way he could have survived. And so Lucius, the head of this order, says, let me take you in. Let me help you. Please come and work for us, because I know you can do better than what those idiots in that room over there would have done with you.
So there's this undercurrent of him trying to redeem himself, and that's why he keeps why he stays with the organization then.
Absolutely.
Okay.
He's got no place else to go. His family thinks he's deserted. Hmm. He's dishonored. He's not necessarily a member of polite society anymore. He really needs to earn a place in this organization. And it's one of the things that freaks him out, is he doesn't think he's good enough.
Well, maybe he doesn't, though. I mean, maybe yes, he does need to restore his honor, but maybe this organization isn't necessarily the place to do that. I mean, it's still kind of, I see that it's, I have to get back what I lost, but it's still, it's not a strong drive. What if he's got some other desire? The desire to restore his honor is a strong one. I think that works, But what if maybe initially, and maybe during the course of this story, this will change part of his arc, is that he doesn't want to be a part of this organization, that he doesn't like having Lucius have to save his hide. I mean, he's basically been emasculated. Lucius has his balls now. If it weren't for Lucius, he'd be in jail or strung up as a traitor. Maybe there's something in America that leads him to the source of this dragon, this German attack, this pirate attack on his ship, that makes him want to go out there to pursue the truth so he can salvage his own honor rather than having somebody else hold it for him.
I like that.
Something to think about. Sorry, Maurice, didn't mean to hijack your mic,
No, you're fine. The only other thing I had was a world building question. Was that all right? So Britain has this agency which goes around dealing with magical threats. Does Texas have one? And would the Indians, United Indian Nations, would they have one also? Because I know that MI5, MI6, they can't just run around in America with impunity. They're going to come across other agencies and invade their jurisdictions and have to deal with them also. So I'm wondering if there's that sort of level of intrigue that goes into this also.
Not so much with the Indian Nations that I've thought up, mm-hmm. but with the Texans, definitely. The Texans have their Rangers,
okay.
who are basically... You know, think of your traditional old school heroic fantasy paladin, except mm-hmm. instead of armor and a nice. Sword, it's the silver badge and a six shooter.
Good job.
Okay. Yeah, I like that. That's awesome. And I can see the United Indian Nations having a strong coalition of shamans,
right.
and a strong spirit tie to that spirit realm. Where they're not necessarily their deities, but their guides and ancestors dwell.
Right, but because they've been kind of isolated for a while, they haven't necessarily developed an international agency that does this kind of thing.
Okay, so their nationalism, nation nationalism is new.
Yes.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, but I think that still speaks to what we talked about earlier too. So I think that whole thread works. The idea that they're aligned, they're correlated, they have this union within each other, but like you said, they don't have that international presence. But as long as, you know, that's reflected in a way where I as a reader don't read that and acknowledge the statements that we're talking about an organization of Native American Indians, and that they are correlated, but they give their organization a name and uniforms, if that makes sense. You know, like, that's not what I would expect at all. And that sort of flies in the face of that concept that they're not about the titles. They being, you know, that general stereotype about Native Americans at the time, that they're not about those titles so much as they are about the union and what they stand for, et cetera, et cetera. So it does, I think it does speak to that component. Okay. I know we're going to dance around a lot about this too, but I think this might be an appropriate time to ask this question. I hope so, because I'm going to. So
here it goes.
Yeah. Talking about this British organization, their power, their authority. I'm glad Maurice brought that up because it did raise a question in my mind. You had spoken about how Branson kidnaps Annie Oakley, attempts to stage her murder to make it look like the natives did it. If I'm getting this right or if I'm getting it wrong, stop me. That doesn't work. You know, wag of the finger. We got you.
Okay.
How come?
Well, not only how come, but at that point, why aren't there like fireworks and huge red flags going off back at home base? And why isn't someone of significant more authority, a la Lucius from the sounds of things, or someone like that, being sent in here to stop this shit from going down? Like, why would our main character be left to his own devices at this point? Or is he?
Two things come to mind. First of all, is that while this is a group of hyper-competent people, because they're hyper-competent, there aren't a lot of them. And so their resources can get spread thin at times. Plus, Branson has done a fairly good job of covering his tracks. Nobody knows that Branson has this secret kind of benefactor who's urging him to take the steps that he takes. And so... that kind of weakens the order just a little bit, that they didn't know that was going on. Maybe they did. Maybe the fact is that the reason that Annie Oakley is taking him is because Lucius is very much aware of Branson's proclivities. And in the papers that he sends, he basically tells Annie, this guy is at your disposal, use him well, and report back to me. I want to see how he does on the field by himself.
Would they leave him to this, though? I mean, doesn't there come a point where it's like, oh, crap, you can't let the new guy do this?
What about this? What about this? What if Norris is conducting this menial delivery of papers? Mm-hmm. And during the transfer of papers, he sees Branson, and Branson comes in, and he's got like a ring or maybe something a little more sophisticated than that, but a ring or a brooch or something that ties Branson to something that Norris saw during the pirate attack that dishonored him.
Oh, something. I know exactly what that is.
Okay, so Norris sees Branson. Right off the bat, we know Branson's a bad guy. And you can spend the whole first act totally decrying that and showing everything that Branson does. Butter won't melt in his mouth. Sugar won't melt. Whatever it is that doesn't melt in his mouth, it won't melt in his mouth because he's perfect. And Norris is so totally wrong about this, but he's not. And then when he sees that, Norris now says, crap, I got to be on this thing. And he appeals to Annie Oakley. Miss Oakley, please, please, please let me come with you. And then Annie Oakley says, okay, fine. I won't give you the answer. You have to come with me in order to fulfill your mission, blah, blah, blah. And now Annie Oakley's an ally of Norris's. She can be a mentor character, which would piss Phoebe off no end if she doesn't like her grandma. Yeah. And then instantly, now suddenly Norris is a suck up in Phoebe's eyes, and she does not like him at all, which gives you even more turf to build that burgeoning romance.
Oh, Maurice, I love this.
What do you think?
Wow, I'm just enraptured listening to it. I want this story.
Yep. Cool. Now what can we do for Phoebe and Norris to foster some romance? Does Norris need to impress her somehow, or how do we get past Phoebe's initial dislike of Norris?
Well, how does this Texas delegate play into their little romance also?
Ooh, yeah, triumvirate. Ooh, yes.
Okay, so this Texas guy, and I still don't have a name for him, has had the hots for Phoebe for some time and has been pursuing her romantically. And she likes him because he's dashing and handsome and, you know,
rich
and competent. You know, he's a decent guy. And the thing that has kept her from saying, yes, let's go do whatever, is the fact that she knows him and she knows the culture he comes from. And that is a culture deep south during that time. The little woman's at home taking care of the kids.
She has no career. She will have no future other than homemaker.
Right. And she just doesn't want that life for herself. The resolution of that comes about through two ways. Either I'm going to have to kill this guy off, or Norris is going to have to do something. Well, probably both. I'm going to have to kill the guy off, and Norris is going to have to win her over. So that after she's decided that Norris is really the guy she wants to be with anyway, then I can safely eliminate that character and get him out of the way. But the resolution comes about when Annie Oakley takes her granddaughter aside and says, okay, look, I know you've been hero worshiping me, and you think that my life has been all heroics and grandstanding and audiences and blah, 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 blah. But you remember the fact that you're here. That means that at some point I had a family, and I and my husband made space and time for that because it was the most important thing to us. You are selling yourself short by not allowing yourself to have this experience here, which will make you a better person.
Yeah,
I'd be very careful with a lot of that. One thing you said there that scares me is the idea that the suitor has to die.
Yeah, that raised red flag for me also, just because killing him off, it seems like too easy of a resolution for the triangle.
Well, and it then can't happen until the triangle's resolved, is the thing.
Well, but then he becomes a ghost. Then Norris can't compete with him.
Yep, that was my other note, was you're competing against his ghost, and that can kill a romance.
Okay.
Good point.
Not only that, but from a very rudimentary level, I just concerned when the romantic interest dies, then that makes me immediately kind of go, aw, shucks, buddy is now the best of what's left.
Right.
Not the best option.
See, and I can see this initial meeting when Norris walks in and Phoebe, you know, and again, I'm kind of going against what you've laid down, Zach, and have Phoebe being one of the primary delegates of this enterprise, and Norris, of course, being the first person that she would meet, and Norris is this sort of dour, dark-browed, stiff British man, very, very proper, and Phoebe's this very competent woman, and maybe there's some initial, hey, you're kind of neat, hey, so are you, and they goes in to meet Annie Oakley, and then Norris sees Branson and petitions to Annie Oakley and becomes, you know, Annie Oakley's mentor, basically, and Phoebe, and he watches and sees Phoebe's eyes flash. And you know, then the Texas delegate is there, and she kind of leans against him or whatever. And there's this whole, you know, big swinging dick match between the Texas guy and Norris.
Yes!
And Phoebe is saying, I'm having none of either of you. You're all pissing me off. And of course, throughout
which winds up at some point with them on the trail, having drunken themselves both into a stupor and going out to see, okay, whose dick really is bigger.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Yep.
Shooting cans and bottles and blowing them up with wands and who knows what.
Yep.
And absolutely. They come back with that. And they come back and it's that scene at the end of The Quiet Man when it's woman of the house and John Wayne's leaning on the guy and they come in and they eat and then everything is okay because they had that fight and they finally worked out their tension.
Yeah. Well, and ultimately, I think Phoebe ultimately needs to prove herself as a fiercely independent woman, not needing Branson, not needing Norris. At some point, Norris needs to, Texas boy needs right. to do something that totally assumes Phoebe's incompetence, and then she demonstrates utter and complete confidence and it shatters his, he's, you know, he'll make a comment like, well, you're not going to be doing that when we're married. And, the crowd goes quiet. And then she rips him a new one and we go on from there. I don't know. So.
I think that would work great. Mainly because what I'm hearing is a lot of, I know you didn't mean to, but this is funny because when we were talking to Maurice on that 20 minutes episode we did a couple days ago, I remember very distinctly he made that statement that sometimes theme kind of, I'm getting the words wrong, Maurice, so please feel free to yell at me here. Sometimes theme sort of appears. It's not intentional.
They reveal themselves, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm starting to really smell that theme of, you know, confidence and competence and what does it take to inspire a person to have self-belief and self-confidence.
Yes.
Really growing out of this. You've got three very distinct characters that evoke that.
And if we align the larger story of this burgeoning alliance along those same lines, because it sounds like, you know, the United Indian Nations are kind of in the same boat. They aren't feeling like they're empowered or a part of things or being able to stand on their own. And honestly, this alliance is probably the absolute worst thing for them because they'll be consumed by these hyperpowers of Britain and the Republic of Texas, which kind of means Branson's doing them a favor, which makes him not much of a villain.
Wait, what?
What? I'm postulating that this alliance is a bad idea for the United Indian Nations. That joining with a hyper-powerful ancient empire of Britain and the obviously heavily armed and very American Republic of Texas, my first thought when I hear about that is, okay, of these three, who's the weakest? Who's going to be the bitch?
If the Indians didn't have their own power, that would be true.
Okay.
But there is definitely something that has kept the Britons from moving across the Missouri. There is definitely something that is keeping the Texans in their place that both sides fully, absolutely, positively respect.
Okay. So once this alliance is done, then does that go away?
No, because that's inherent in the Indians. It has to do with their magic. They're able to do things with magic that no one else can, because part of the way it works in this world is that magic is an expression of who you are and how you perceive the world around you. And so because the Indians have a very different relationship with kind of nature and the world around them, they're able to do things in magic that nobody else has seen before because of this, you know, westernizing influence. So when the Indians realize what they're doing is something of a deal with the devil, but they're trying to set their own terms so they don't lose that core of who they are while they're still able to have things like cotton gins.
Well, let me riff on this just a little. I see what you're saying. I totally see what you're saying. But let me riff on this a little bit. Let's postulate for a moment that this is a bad idea for the Indian states, that ultimately once, I mean, obviously the Republic of Texas, everybody wants something in this relationship, and there's lots of positive, oh yes, well, it'll be mutually supportive, but really the United Indian Nations have some really sweet land. And some superb resources that, you know, if the relationship goes on long enough, you know, Britain and the Republic of Texas will just kind of move in and yeah, let's elbow you guys. And then the same thing that happened to the Indians is going to happen again. The reason I like this is because that makes our bad guy a good guy. That makes Branson, now his methods, his tactics, totally wrong. But giving him a strong moral leg to stand on, you know, bad execution for a good reason, that's rich. That, I mean, that lets you, when the villain stands up in monologues, and I'm not proposing that he does, but, you know, but when he does that, he has a leg to stand on. He can make a compelling argument that Norris and Phoebe and any of the other characters involved are going to have to really consider. And it puts a kind of a gray thing on a black and white world. Just something to consider.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Gentlemen, I'm looking at the time, and I know there's so much more to talk about. But I don't want this thing to spill over too much farther. So what I'd like to do is go around the table one more time, and everybody, whatever notes you have, whatever thoughts you have, give them to Zach. Send him off with a big old pocket of literary gold so he can ponder and consider how best to use what we give him. Maurice, we'll lead off with you. Closing thoughts, things that we didn't get to that you had been considering, anything along those lines. It's all yours.
Okay. I'm all about the world building. So the more time you can spend, you know, providing the little details in this world, you know, the better my little geek heart gets. but then, yeah, my last concern was basically about the nature of Branson. Because I don't want him to be derailed into some sort of cartoony, you know, riff on, you know, Republicans or conservatives, something like that. I like the idea of a nuanced villain who, because, you know, in the end, no villain wakes up and goes, hey, I'm going to be evil today. You know, everybody's the hero in their own story.
Right.
And so giving him that nuanced edge, and I love the idea of that moral leg to stand on, adds a richness and depth to that villain. And so I didn't want him, with all the intrigue that's going on, I didn't want him to be pushed to the side in the story. There's a lot going on in the story.
No kidding.
And I wanted him to have a depth and a resonance so that even though he might not have as much screen time, you can always feel his presence in the story.
That's an excellent point.
A really excellent point, yeah. I think that merits a lot of mention, yeah.
Ryan, what about you, sir?
Yeah, you got a lot here, man. The funny thing is when we started here and you said you hadn't written anything bigger than 50 or 60,000, and Maurice said he saw like 180,000 words here, I caught myself saying, no, you're probably looking at 70 or 80, but now that I've thought that, by the time we've gone through this conversation, hell no, dude.
Yeah,
warm up the keyboard, dude, because it's going to get a workout. There's a lot of things going on here. I think you've got a really strong base to build on, and I would encourage you to be cognizant of that theme again that was alluded to, that the writer will never see, that this has that adventure / James Bond feel to it. I say that because it can fly in the face of some of the things here that I think are strong points. A good example of that is, ironically, this conversation we're having about Branson and that villain and who he is and why he's doing what he's doing. I think you've got something really strong there. Heed Maurice's words on that, because you've got to really make sure that he stays that competent villain that isn't standing in the back waxing his mustache. On the flip side, the problem is that in most James Bond movies or that type of story, that's exactly what they are. Our cookie cutter. Yeah. So that's why I'm saying there's got to be a balance that you're going to have to decide on here. And based on the strength of the way and the passion that you've displayed here over this show, I'm going to recommend you start walking away from making that allegory to James Bond anymore. I don't think that's important to you. I think you need to really recognize that you have a thematically powerful story here if you want it to be that way, and that you have a good villain, air quote, in Branson, as long as you respect him. For lack of a better way to put it, don't make him the iodine in the water.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Well said. And for myself, I got to agree. This is a big work, Zach. If nothing else, because of all of the different world building, the potential for info dumpage here is dreadfully huge.
Good point.
And just because of that, you cannot, under any circumstance, we forbid you, by the power vested in us by the round table, to info dump. Which means that any element or component of the world that you need to or wish to expand on, there's going to need to be a representative there. You know, I think there needs to be a representative from the Indian nations as a part of this delegation in New York that's going to wherever this final treaty is or ratification is taking place. And having that individual also as a part of the story. I mean, you've almost got like a Scooby gang here making their way across the nation on their way to this ratification point. So finding opportunities in dialogue and in action to reveal and unfold this wonderful, rich story that world that you've evolved, I think is going to be incredibly compelling and a real challenge for you. One thing that occurred to me as you were describing the arc was Branson doesn't make his move until Act 2, where he engineers the kidnapping of himself and Annie Oakley. So she'll be pickled with feathers, and then the dragon is the backup. That bothered me. That dragon is epic. And having it as a backup plan, as just in case this other thing doesn't work, I've got this nuclear bomb over here. Why don't you play the nuclear bomb first? What I was wondering was, what if there's more than Branson wanting to sabotage this thing? What if there are delegates from the Republic of Texas that don't want to be aligned with those filthy Indians or those stuck-up British? Maybe they're the ones that, you know, thought slavery should have stuck around a little bit longer, whatever. I don't want to paint them as cardboard cutouts of the Ku Klux Klan or whatever, but, you know, there's going to be discontents. They could be hatching their own plans that harry the group through Act One. And that allows you to reveal some history of the Republic of Texas and blah, 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 and then actually have Branson step in and stop the assassination attempt on Oakley, thus calling into question, is he really a villain or not? Then all along, he's pulling this dragon thing. And you need to foreshadow that dragon thing somehow. I don't know how. Whether it's visions from the Indian talking about this dark dragon vision or having dragons attacking them or behaving strangely or something. Something that indicates something is building. You've got to build that ticking clock of dread. Ryan, you got something real quick?
I just got, real quick. You mentioned that there was a scene in Japan that started at the beginning that was an action piece. It was going to start this thing off there. Yeah, right. Allude to it there.
Yes. Mm. Yep. Excellent. Then you plant the seed for the end game right in the prologue. Fabulous. God, we're good. we are just fucking
high fives.
Oh, all around high five, bro hugs. Awesome. All right. Gentlemen, I got to call a stop to this. We're already well into our red zone of time. Although clearly, Zach, we could keep talking about this. And this type of thing does not happen with bland stories. So you've got dynamite in your hands here. And here's the deal, Zach. When you go out and you finish this story and you audio it up, you ebook it, you get one of the big six to grovel at your feet and give you a sweet deal. However this thing goes out into the real world, when that happens, you come back here. And we will knight you. We will make you a knight of the round table, baby. and we've got swords, there's fanfare, there's speeches. It's huge. It's epic. And there's food. We'll have Maurice come in and cater. So we'll kill you by food.
And Maurice is cooking. It's done. Done deal. I'm there.
Done.
Bam.
Done.
Bam. Awesome. Awesome. So that's the deal. So, Zach, dude, thank you so much for offering such a sweet repast. You are indeed the sous chef of death. This is fabulous. Thank you so much, man.
Writing skills aren't everything that's under the apron. That's all I'm going to say.
Oh, dude, ladies. Ladies, take note. Ah, excellent. And Maurice, dude, this has been a blast, man. Thank you so much for making the time and playing in our sandbox. Welcome. This has been good.
Yeah, I've had a ball. I've had an absolute ball.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Yeah, us too. Us too. This is good stuff. And as long as gratitude is being flung about, we must turn the camera out to the audience out there and say, dudes, thank you. Now, I know you guys have more ideas. I'm looking at, there's a few people out there I'm looking at very specifically. You know who you are. The opportunity to continue this discussion happens in the comment section of the post for this episode. Hit those comments. Whatever other ideas you got for Zach, throw them out there. Zach, I'll make sure you know about that. And while you're drafting those, if you're in a writing mode, you know, a review at iTunes is always a welcome thing. So many of you have gone out there and done that. And we, I mean, that's like buying us, you know, Café du Monde and beignets with honey. That's just sweet food for us. And we so appreciate that. Drop us a line if you're so inclined, thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. And, Ryan, are you feeling it, man?
Oh, bro. You don't even know.
Yep. This was Roundtable Gold. This was Roundtable Gold.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
Awesome. Well, and thank you, bud, for stepping up and wingmanning for me. I know Brian appreciates it, and I do too, bud. You did a great job.
Thanks.
Sweet. All right. Now, friends, I know you're sitting here, you're panting like we are, drenched in sweat, going, oh, my God, what an epic event. But you know what? In just a few days, it's going to start all over again. We're going to have more awesome guest hosts, more brave and creative guest writers, more stories to workshop, more literary gold to mine. So come back in a couple of days, and it will all start over again. Ryan, what do you think, man? What, you know, they've got a couple of days to kill. What should they be doing?
Hey, you know my advice. It's always the same thing. Hydrate, get some sleep, get ready, because this bad boy, when you pull the cord, she goes...
Yes, I love it. Hydrate and get your rest.
Gotta stay hydrated, people. Gotta stay hydrated.
That's awesome. I like that. And while you're hydrating, you know, guys, you find what you're looking for. You always find what you're looking for. You can look for grumpy, but I don't recommend it. You know, look for awesome. Look for wow, because it's out there too. And if you're sniffing for it, it'll land in your lap. So thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you guys in a couple of days. Until then, stay frosty. We'll be thinking of you. Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.